Welcome to Season 3 of Hashing Out the Law. I'm your host, Arash Hashemi. Our guest this episode is my good friend and colleague, Puya Parto. Puya is a patent attorney, and he's going to explain the process of obtaining a patent, what a trademark is, and what constitutes a copyright. Puya's work includes assisting clients with patent reexamination and reissuing, litigation support, infringement analysis, validity analysis, freedom to operate analysis, and trademark prosecution oppositions. I hope you enjoy. Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Hashing Out the Law. This is Season 3. On this episode, I have a good friend of mine, Mr. Dr. Puya Parto. That's an inside joke, people. Mr. Puya Parto is a patent attorney, and I had him on because I want him to explain what being a patent attorney is and how patents actually work. Now, Puya, we all know you're an attorney. We know you're a patent attorney. Could you explain to us what it means to be a patent attorney? Is it just going to law school, passing the bar, or do you have to do something extra to be a patent attorney?
You have to do extra. Thanks for having me on, first and foremost, and going by my doctorate title. to be a patent attorney, you need to take not only the regular bar, you have to take the patent bar as well. You do not have to go to law school to take the patent bar exam. If you take the patent bar exam without going to law school, you're a patent agent. And you can prepare patents on behalf of people and file on behalf of inventors and file the patents and prosecute the patents with the patent office. To qualify for the patent bar, you need to have a science degree, a BS in a hard science, so math, engineering, some life sciences, not psychology. I know there's BS in business. Those BSs don't count.
Those BS and, are BS.
Yes. in terms of the patent bar, they are. And also some BSs in sciences, hard sciences, don't count. For a while, I guess it was the 90s, a BS, for example, from computer science from UC Irvine wouldn't qualify you to sit for the patent bar.
I have a question before you go forward. If I don't have to go to law school and I can take the patent bar and be a patent agent, why would I want to be a patent attorney? Why can't I just be an agent and skip law school altogether?
First and foremost, money. You make more money.
Okay.
I mean, we're all here. Some of us aren't here to just help people. Some of us are here to make money as well. That, and then also you can do other stuff. You know, I can advise clients on different matters outside of just prosecuting patents. It opens more doors for you. But if you just want to, you know, some people have, for example, PhDs, multiple science PhDs, they don't want to go to school anymore. And they've written patents themselves, and they've become a patent agent and an expert in this particular area, and law firms will hire them. And that's a good way of making a living as well.
I have another question for you. So if you're a patent agent, but not a patent attorney, you can file for the patents. Can you advise the clients on any legal consequences or any legal ramifications of the patent?
No, you can't give any legal advice.
Okay, so you can just, basically you're just a filing agent, for lack of better terms, right?
No, you also prepare the patent as well. You're qualified to prepare the patent.
Okay, could you explain to the listeners and viewers what it means to prepare a patent?
Sure. So preparing the patent means the inventor comes to you with an idea. You can either just write the patent in the proper format that's required by the patent office. And there's proper language that should be used to make sure that the invention stands up in court or stands up against other patents and can be properly asserted to when someone's infringing the invention. But beyond that, it also, there's some advising that goes on. We advise our clients on whether their idea is patentable or not. And this is an area where there's some confusion sometimes as to what's patentable, what isn't patentable, how do you actually get a patent? And there's a lot of myths around there. And hopefully we can clarify some of those myths today.
Before we clarify those myths, let me ask you this. So I'm an inventor, I come to you, you write the patent, you submit the patent. And I know sometimes people say patent pending. So explain to us what that means. There's patent pending or there's a patent that's been granted. What is the difference and what is the legal protection you get in each step?
Patent pending simply means the patent application has been filed with the patent office. You don't get any legal protection at that point. Patent granted means the patent office has allowed your application. And once it's allowed, you get patent protection. The reason you put patent pending on an app, on a device or packaging or anywhere else is to put people on notice that there's a patent. Because once I say, Arash, you're infringing my patent, I need to show that you knew about my patent. You had knowledge. That's one of the requirements for infringement. I also have to provide notice that there's a patent. So if I have patent pending, it can say you were on notice since this date that there's a patent pending and you should have looked it up to make sure to see if the patent was issued. Once that patent is issued, I also need to update my packaging to say patent issued or this product is protected under these patents. You used to see that a lot on packages. They changed the requirements. You can now put it on your website. You just have a link and list all the patents that are protected, that your products are protected by.
Okay. All right, that explains it. At least it explains it in a way where it's more clear for me. Let's move on. You were talking about the myths. Let's tell us about what these myths are and clear them up for us, please.
Sure. So there's two basic requirements to get a patent. One, your idea needs to be new, and two, it needs to be non-obvious. And a really easy way to explain this is the spork. If you go to KFC, they have the spork, the spoon and the fork. So if you're the first person to invent the spork, your invention is new. But it's arguably obvious because the spork is the combination of the spoon and the fork. So if I was to file a spork patent application with the patent office, the patent examiner would come back and say, okay, this is new, you've passed that hurdle, but this is an obvious combination of the spoon and the fork. My job as a patent attorney before this would be to, one, know that this rejection would be possible by the patent office and to foresee that and to put into the application why this spork isn't obvious in view of what's already out there. So the patent application would explain, this is the spoon, these are the problems, this is the fork, these are the problems, and this is the problem that my invention overcomes.
Right, let me ask you a question that comes to my mind. So I'm the first person who invented this spork and I passed the first hurdle that no one's invented this before. And then the second hurdle of, well, this is obvious. Couldn't my answer be, yeah, it's obvious, but nobody did it. I'm the first one who did it. That's not sufficient enough?
It is, but it isn't. Because it doesn't, you need to, in order to do that, you need to bring a lot of evidence that other people have tried this or failed, or there's market research showing that other people have, why this wouldn't have been possible previously. Or why, you know, you've brought it into market and it's taken off and there's other reasons why it hasn't worked before. Those are really hard arguments to make and it's not worthwhile. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's not it's not the your best foot forward. The best foot forward would be to say, you know, they probably have thought of it, but these are the issues when you combine the two. Maybe you found a specific angle to have the fork and the spoon merge together, and you know, previous people that would cut your mouth or wouldn't put enough food onto the into the spoon portion, or wouldn't be able to grab the items with the fork portion. Those are the things that you need to, it needs to be an improvement on what's already out there.
I see, okay.
And that's the easiest way to do it, is to say, okay, these are the problems that existed, this is what I'm fixing, or this is how I'm making it better. And the next hurdle, which has come up a lot, is especially in software, is, or tech mostly, is what problem in technology are you solving? Not so much that, okay, this problem existed, it would take a human 100 hours to do it, I'm applying a computer and the computer will do it in 1 hour. That's no longer patentable. So you need to say, this is a problem that existed in technology and this is a technological solution to the problem. Not that I'm just making it faster to do it by applying a computer.
Could you do that before?
About 10 years ago, you could.
Okay, all right.
But not anymore.
Okay, so I've come to you, we cleared those two hurdles that you were talking about. What happens next?
Next is I draft the application. We put a background saying this is what it's related to. This is a spork, it's related to eating. And here's the diagrams of my invention. Here's different ways that it could be made. Here's different, there's, we call them embodiments. Here's different embodiments of the spork. You want to cover yourself in case, one, you want to kind of future see that say, okay, here's where the future of the spork industry is going, and future proof yourself. For example, if you're drafting a computer, if you're the first person to invent those old PDAs, okay, you might want to future proof yourself to say, so that your patent can, if you future proofed yourself properly, your patent application would read onto an iPad or an iPod, and you wouldn't limit yourself to a specific handheld device such as a PDA. If you didn't future proof yourself, your patent would be only limited to the PDA.
Like and the Palm Pilot. So if I had a Palm Pilot, but I only had my pen applied to the Palm Pilot, and then you came along, you took my technology and applied it to the iPhone, then I'm out of luck.
Exactly.
Okay.
So, or for example, if you have a wireless patent, you say this is related to LTE, and now 5G comes out. Also, your patent doesn't apply to 5G anymore, but you want to write it in a way that it can last for the term of the patent.
Okay. Now let me ask you a question that comes to mind. What if you write it and you make it lastable for just a new word, pan that. But the technology that comes later on was not foreseeable when you wrote the patent. What do you do then?
Well, that's part of the trick. You want to try to make it foreseeable to say, you know, the fundamentals of technology are pretty much going to be the same. Like some signal is going to be sent and something's going to happen based on that signal being sent. Something's going to be scanned and something will happen in terms of that being scanned. You want to write it broad enough to encompass those future technologies. Some things are inevitable that, you know, you can't have a patent for a horse-drawn carriage and have it apply to a car. Or you can't have a rotary phone patent apply to a cell phone. Then you're out of luck. But in terms of modern technology, there's ways you can try to foresee what's going to happen down the pipeline. Sometimes you're just painting yourself into a corner.
All right. Okay, so then you write the patent and then you submit it for approval?
Yeah, you submit it for examination, and it takes about 2 to 3 years for the patent to be examined by the patent office. That time you just sit and wait. And then they come back with their first response. Usually it's a rejection. In fact, we try, if we get a patent allowed on the first try without it getting rejected, we either didn't do a good enough job or it was really, really something new. Because we always try to get more of the piece of the pie than we can, so that like a broader claim. If you look, so maybe let me step back a bit. The most essential part of the patent is the claim, which is at the very end. So it'll say what is claimed, and if you read a patent, it'll say claim one, and it'll describe what your invention is. So if, for example, for a spork, it would say utensil for eating comprising a handle, a rounded top, and I don't know what you call it, fingers coming out of the round part. And so that is what is applied to someone who's infringing. And so the patent office will examine that and say, okay, here's the handle of the spoon, and here's the round part of the other of the spoon, and then here's the fingers of the fork. So we try to claim more than we can, get a little more broader. That way we do future proof ourselves and you have it apply to more infringers. The patent office will come back and say, okay, you're kind of overstepped your boundaries. Let's take it back a little bit. And then we have a back and forth to see where we can actually draw the line in the sand and say, this is what the invention is. So if we've claimed it too narrowly, then they're gonna allow it right away. And you don't wanna do that, unless, you know, you might, but it's rare.
All right, and then you were talking about other myths. What other myths were you mentioning?
The other myths were actually, it comes back to the claims, is you'll read a patent and they'll say, okay, so-and-so got a patent on, I don't know, if you read any headline, they'll say Apple got a patent on this, or Google got a patent on that. And you're like, well, how can they patent something so obvious? Or anybody could have thought of that. But the truth of the matter is, if you go and read the claims, it's actually some nuanced improvement on a previous technology. And the actual patent might be directed to something very, 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 a small detail or a small improvement on a previous system. So most patents don't cover a very broad scope of a product. It's actually one small feature that you're actually patenting. It could be how to write data onto a CD. It could be, you know, improving how your actual cell phone signal gets sent or received, or reducing interference. So patents aren't as broad or all encompassing as people believe they are. And, you know, when someone says, oh, I want a patent, you know, Uber doesn't have a patent on hailing cars with your cell phone. Their patents are directed to, you know, how do I make it faster for that car to get to me? How do I make it faster for the driver, for me to find the right driver? Or how do I improve the signaling that goes between the drivers communicating or communicating with the app? It's a little nuanced improvements like that that are what patents are actually directed to.
I see. My next question for you is, I have an idea. My idea is not protected though, is it? Like if I tell you about my idea, not as an attorney, as a friend, we're over beers and I tell you about my idea and you think that my idea is great, but you tell me, you know what, your idea kind of sucks. And then you turn around and you take my idea and you go and get a patent on it and make a bunch of money. I can't turn around and sue you because you stole my idea, can I?
No, you cannot.
Okay.
So, however, in California, which is one of the few states with this law, you can actually sue if I hired you for this idea or I gave you consideration for this idea. So There's actually case law about this, and there was a case with related to Lost, the TV show. And this law in California exists because of Hollywood. So if I hired you as a screenwriter and I said, I want you to come up with some ideas for TV shows, and I came up with some ideas, then my idea is protected. Otherwise, your idea is not protected.
Okay. Well, that kind of makes sense. I hired you, you came up with an idea, I told you your idea sucks, and then I used it anyway, then you can sue me. But yeah. If you're having beers and I tell you my idea and you say your idea sucks and you use it, I'm out of luck.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Now I'm going to jump from patents to trademarks. What is the difference between patents and trademarks? And do I need to be a patent attorney to file a trademark?
First question, last question first. No, you don't need to be a patent attorney to file a trademark. Anybody can file a trademark. You have to be, an attorney has to file on your behalf, but you don't need to be a patent attorney. On another point, an asterisk, you don't need to be a patent attorney to file your patent if you're the actual inventor. There's a loophole in the law, but you have to be the actual inventor to file your own patent. It's not advised, but it's possible. But back to trademarks. Trademarks protect brands and brand names, brand colors, brand signs, even branding of a store. For example, when you walk into a In-N-Out, you know it's an In-N-Out. So if McDonald's decides to copy the color scheme and layout of an In-N-Out, it's called trade dress. They can infringe a trade dress. Those are important marks to protect. The reason for trademarks is to prevent customer confusion. It's to prevent somebody from creating a Coca-Cola that's not Coca-Cola and confusing the customer. So they're there. The purpose of them is to protect your brand. So like I said, it's a name, Hashimi Law. It's the logo, the Nike swoosh. It's the colors, the red of Louis Vuitton's. Trade dress, sounds. For example, I'm trying to think of a sound trademark, but it's not coming to mind.
Well, I love the examples you gave already. By the way, the Hashemi Law logo is trademark, so don't try to steal it. Okay.
Good. I know.
As for sounds, what about like cartoon sounds? Like, and this, you know, I'm just asking the question because it popped into my head. Like, Bugs Bunny says, "What's up, Doc?" Can that be trademarked? I mean, that's a sound. But is it more of a saying?
It can, but that would be more of a saying. It could be, for example, the 20th Century Fox
theme song, or
yeah, the Cubs, or AOL's "You Got Mail," that old sound, something like that could be trademarked.
Okay. What else can be trademarked?
Those are the categories. It's most of the time it's the actual logo, that words of the logo. So this is a difference too. So Coca-Cola can trademark the word Coca-Cola just by itself. So, you know, Pepsi can come up and say and call themselves Coca-Cola in the font of Pepsi, and they would still be infringing the Coca-Cola word mark. The other is the design of the mark. So it's the actual font of how Coca-Cola is spelled. So if Pepsi decides to keep calling itself Pepsi, but use the font of Coca-Cola, they can infringe on the design mark as well. This is all to prevent customer confusion. So that, you know, if you tell your grandma to go buy Coca-Cola and she sees it, she's seen the commercials and she sees the Pepsi one looks like Coca-Cola and she gets confused, she doesn't know which one to buy. Okay. So it's all to protect the consumer.
When you're talking about the font, you're talking about the specific way Coca-Cola is written.
Exactly.
So, but if I use like Times Roman or New Times Roman font, that doesn't mean that font now belongs to me. It's just the way I use that font in my logo, correct?
Exactly.
Okay, all right.
And also when it comes to trademarks, it has to be unique. It can't be descriptive, because you don't want to exclude others from using regular terms. You can't trademark the name barbershop for your barbershop. You can't trademark the word apple for your apple farm, but you can trademark apple for computers. So
I see.
It's all, there's some balance that goes on there as to what can and can't be protected.
So can I trademark the word barbershop for my law office?
Possibly.
Okay. All right.
But barbershop, you know, then that might, that might be a little too generic. If you maybe have unique spelling for barbershop.
That was my next question. I own an apple farm. I can't trademark apple for my apple farm, but if I change the spelling, can I do that?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's why you see a lot of misspelled words for logos and marks and stuff. And you're like, man, they didn't know how to spell. It's like, no, they made it unique because they needed to get the trademark for it.
Right, right. I actually was talking, this is a while back ago, a long time ago, I was talking to this patent attorney, and he represented Skechers Shoes. And the way they came up with the name is the kids would tell the dad, you know, that guy is very sketchy. So the dad came up with the word Skechers, because not only the spelling, but you know, there's no word that existed. So he knew that he would be able to trademark that for his shoes. That was an interesting story. He tells it better than I do. Okay. What else have I missed, or what else is there that you want to talk about when it comes to patent, trademarks, or anything that has to do in the realm of law that you practice?
The last one is, there's two more. There's trade secrets and there's copyrights. Copyrights are pretty easy. It's anything that's put on a tangible medium. So if you wrote it down, if it's recorded somewhere, that's pretty much the only way it's put on tangible medium. It's recorded somewhere. That's protected. So, and that's to provide people who create works protection to create more works, and prevents others from copying that work. There's exceptions to it. For example, if you're doing it for education, you can copy it. If you're doing a live TV show, you can copy it. If you're doing a news program, you can copy it. Otherwise, you can't copy other people's works. That's pretty simple. But people often mistake a copyright with a patent. They say, oh, I should copyright that. Well, you know, as soon as it's put down on tangible medium, it's copyrighted. If to get more protections, you actually file it with the copyright office. You don't need to be a patent attorney to do that. It's simply, you can do it yourself. You just submit your work to the copyright office. The last one is trade secret. This is an actual secret that you protect, and it's necessary for your business. It's a cornerstone of your business. For example, the recipe for Coca-Cola is a trade secret. So I think there's only two or three people at a time who know the recipe, and Coke takes reasonable measures to protect this trade secret. Your client list could be a trade secret. Other trade secrets are like recipes. A lot of restaurant recipes are trade secrets. And if somebody leaves a company, and if I work for KFC and I go to El Pollo Loco and I take the Colonel's 32 spices or whatever it is, and I tell them, then I've misappropriated trademark. Not only have I misappropriated, El Pollo Loco knew that this was a trade secret, they've misappropriated it as well. Okay. And this goes on a lot in the industry. There's, trade secrets are know-how, knowledge of how to do something. Also, knowing what not to do is also a trade secret. So if you've tested something and you know, okay, option A, B, C, and D don't work, but option E works, knowing that options A, B, C, D, and A, B, C, and D don't work is a trade secret. Because if you go to company, the next company over, you're like, okay, these four options won't work. Let's try another one. You've misappropriated a trade secret because you're taking knowledge that you had at another job and applying it someplace else.
You mentioned some things which made me think of some questions. You said like a client's list could be a trade secret, but how do I go protecting that trade secret? Do I actually file it with the trademark office? What do I do?
No, there's no filing. It's all internal. You have to make sure that there's access control for your employees. Your employees sign NDAs. You take necessary measures to protect this information from getting out there.
I see. Okay. So if, let's say I have employees and they leave and they go to another firm and they take my clients with them, if I hadn't put in those measures beforehand, then I can't really come and say this is trade secrets, or I can come and say these are trade secrets, but it would be harder for me to prove because I didn't put those preventive measures in.
Yeah, it'd be harder for you to prove. It'd say, well, you didn't take reasonable measures to protect them. How would anybody know these are trade secrets?
Okay. One other question that comes into mind, and it's more for the general knowledge of people. The patent office, the trademark office, and the copyright office, they're not all the same entity, are they?
The U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, they're under one entity. The Copyright Office is there too, but it's all under one branch of the government. And it's actually, it used to be self-funded until Congress took their funds. Shocking. It was the only self-funded government body.
So who funds them now?
I mean, they get funded and they used to have a surplus, and then the Congress takes their surplus.
Oh, wow. So let me ask you this. It's all one entity, but do I file my trademark and my patent at the same place? I know everything is done electronically now, but my question is not necessarily, do I walk up to the same window? My question is, if I file a trademark online or if I file my patent online, does it go to the same office, for lack of better terms? Or is it a different department within the entity?
Yeah, you go to uspto.gov.
Okay.
And that's all the information is all there for you.
Okay. All right. And we're going to include, for the listeners and the viewers, we're going to include Puya's information in the bio of this episode. So if you guys need to get a hold of Puya, you guys can go to the bio. You can click on the link and get a hold of Puya. And if you have any patents or trademarks or trademark secrets or anything, Puya would definitely be the person who could assist you with that. Is there anything else that we missed, or is there anything, any trade secrets about patents you want to share with us?
No, I mean, I can go on, but I think we covered the basics.
Is there anything that you want to go on about that you think is a interesting nuance that people don't know about, but they should?
I'd say go read a patent. Go to Google Patents or the Patent Office website. Actually read the patent and see what goes in there. Another interesting thing is you can't take a patent for one idea. You can't take something that's used for one use and use it for another use and patent it. You can't say this is my baseball bat and now it's a back scratcher. So it has to be unique.
I see. Can I tie a spork to the end of the baseball bat and then try to patent it as a back scratcher?
Maybe.
I just want to run all these ideas by you. By the way, if you steal these ideas from me, I am going to sue you. Because
the spork scratcher.
I'm going to come up with the name, but I'm not going to tell you until I trademark it, okay?
All right. Sounds good. Oh, trademarks actually, they need to be in use. You can't squat on a trademark. That's a good thing to...
Meaning if I have a trademark and I file it, but I never use it, then someone else can come along and take that trademark from me?
You have 3 years to show that you've used it to be able to get it. In order for the trademark to be registered, you need to show that it's in use. You need to physically provide a specimen of the use. You can file an intent to use, which means I intend to use this. So let me just get all the paperwork out of the way. And once I'm using it, I'll show you that it's in use. And so once it's accepted, you have 3 years to show that it's in use. If not, then your application goes away.
I see. So I can prepare in case I want to use a trademark. I can prepare ahead of time, but I only have 3 years to actually use the trademark. If not, someone else can come along and take it from me.
Yeah, and this is how a lot of people, they monitor what trademarks are registered. And so they find out like new toys that are coming out, new movies that are coming out, like, you know, George Lucas, for example, when might have trademarked Star Wars 1, 2, and 3, that's how people might know that there's new Star Wars movies coming out, or like BMW might trademark like the 650i. So, you know, like there's a new model coming out. So
you're going to monitor my account and see if the new back scratcher is coming out?
Exactly. I'm on to you.
It was a pleasure having you on. I actually learned a lot about patents and trademarks. I would love to pick your head more, but I know you're a busy man and it's a Friday afternoon. It was a pleasure. Again, for the listeners and the viewers, if you want to get in touch with Pooya, you can actually use the link in the bio and you can get in touch with Pooya that way. Pooya, thank you again. It was a pleasure. Thank you. I wish you a very happy weekend.
You too.